Sunnah. We've studied the, you know, the fundamentals of the Gaudiya Vaishnav Siddhanta, Gaudiya Vaishnav philosophy. And so now we will start to look at the others. The next thing we'll be studying is the four sampradayas, but until that stuff is ready, because somehow or another all these years we figured that the work that we were going to be working from was available, and then we just found out that it's not as available as we hoped. So we're just moving to the Tattva Vivek, which would be actually the last book in this study, and then we'll start with that until the other is ready. Basically what it is it's a comparison between our philosophy and all the other different kinds of philosophies and religions in the world. Okay. So this is a book by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Tattva Vivek. Super excellently, but now you have to put up, this is not our translation, so it's going to be, it will be a little interesting unless you're used to Gaudiya translations like that. Super excellently be glorified the Supreme Lord Shri Krishna Chaitanya, the personified blissful manifestation of the eternally existent transcendental reality, by whose grace has been composed this book called Satchidananda Bhuti. Human beings, many days after their birth in this world, efficiently learn and collect the knowledge about the objects of senses. The various materials of this world and their qualities realized by the sense organs are called vishaya, or the objects of the senses. Notice in here the style is that we're not, what we're complaining about is something's non-connection to Krishna. Does that make sense? Like that. It'd be like this. You want to jump off a building, and so you jumped off a skyscraper, or you jumped off a bridge, or you jumped off a dam. Then, you know, but they're all 10 stories high, and you managed to kill yourself. Now, should we be sitting around talking about how jumping off the bridge is stupid? It's so much better to jump off a bridge. Does that make sense? So there's no criticism there. So you see here, is he's giving the living entities that are born within this sphere the credit that they are actually able to look at this world and figure out how to, through their senses, gain something from it. So that takes intelligence, because the senses are based on intelligence. Intelligence is not working. You can't use the senses. So he says here, they efficiently learn and collect the knowledge about the objects of senses. Right, so they do that quite well. So no one's saying that they're stupid in eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Right? What we're saying is that it's not connected to Krishna, therefore it's useless. Does that make sense? So in the same way as whether it's modern or it's Vedic, if it's not connected to Krishna, it's useless. Right? That's why the Gaudiyas are sometimes so difficult to understand. Because just following the Vedic, if it's not connected to Krishna, is also useless. Right? Does that make sense? We should not, within our minds, due to atheism, bring up, well, what if we're following the modern connected to Krishna? Is that better than not following the Vedic? What is the purpose? We've made it clear that connected to Krishna, it's useful. Not connected to Krishna, it's not useful. All that argument only shows symptoms that one is not interested in Vedic culture and one wants to be free to do anything you please. Right? Does this make sense? Right, so we should always avoid that kind of attitude. Okay. So, as the sense equipments of children gradually attain maturity, the qualities of the sense objects also are realized by them accordingly. Right, so as their senses develop, then they understand how to use them in a more refined way. What are the sense objects available? Right, unrefined sense is happy with an unrefined sense object. Refined sense is happy with the refined sense object, right? So in an intelligent society, naturally they're going to be refined, they're going to be developed, right? We see any culture that had a lot of learning and everything, they're known for their refinement, right? In sense gratification. Does that make sense? Doesn't mean their sense gratification is appropriate according to the Vedic standard, and or that they are actually getting the enjoyment they're hoping to get. But in any case, as they refine, their senses and sense objects then also refine. Does that make sense? So that's not a problem. That should be appreciated. That's why you can't just say, oh, all the gross, disgusting, stinky, smelly karmis. No. Some are like that. Some are very refined. They're not stinky and smelly. But they're still karmis. Right? So where they're refined, you give them that due, then you have something to work with. Right? Because if they're refined, then who's more refined than Krishna? If they're intelligent, who's more intelligent than Krishna? Right? So therefore, there's something for them to find in the Vedic culture. But if they're just dirty, stinky, smelly, then what is it they're going to gain? How are they going to relate to the Vedic culture since they've already been put outside it? Does this make sense? So the idea of this is to find out where is the Vedic culture and where is all these different philosophies in the world. And then understanding that from there, then you pull it in. Does this make sense? When the sense organs learn to relish the qualities of the sense objects, proportionately the sense organs are influenced by their attraction. And in this way, the human beings get attached to the objects of senses, that in due course they engage themselves in no other activity than in the contemplation of those objects. Right? So as they go, they learn to engage them and learn to refine them, but then the problem is then they're only engaged in these things. Does that make sense? That's all they do. Like that. It's funny how if you're just in the natural environment, all the birds, and it's so nice. But as soon as you add in these pukka buildings, then immediately they become overemphasized. You know what I'm saying? And it loses that romantic quality. Like that. It's like I remember. We haven't gotten here because there's not so many frogs, but at the old school, there'd be tons of frogs because they were, lower ground and right next to the pond. So all these bamboos that are like this, so the ones inside stay nice, but the ones outside, generally they rot, and the first thing to rot is the hole in the top. So what happens is these little dinky frogs, I'm not joking, they're about inch and a half big, they crawl up and get inside the bamboo, right? And so then they sit in there and croak. And you think this 10-foot frog is croaking because they get really happy doing it because they always do it. It makes them really feel big. You get in there, grow. You know, wow, what's that? And then you find this little dinky frog, like that. So same way here. You've got one bird sitting over there, and then it makes so much noise. The affinity towards sound, touch, form, taste, and smell becomes the invariable companions of human mind, and they make it to be their slave. Right? Because remember, what we were discussing before is the sense and the sense object enter each other. Right? So the mind contemplates the sense object, so it enters it, so therefore then that sense object enters the mind. Right, so then that is the companion, that's what you're always with, and the senses and the sense objects. Human beings get engrossed into and enchanted by the respective sense objects, this being the normal course of ordinary human life. Among them, some may rarely happen to have the discretion that the one who is born as inevitable has inevitability to die, and after death, one cannot continue his relation with the objects of senses. The one who happens to be fortunate enough to have this discretion will detach himself from the sense objects and engage in the inquiry of reality. That person will put to himself the following three questions. 1. Being the enjoyer of this material world, who am I? 2. What is this enormous universe in reality? And 3. What is the true relationship between this world and myself? Okay, so in other words, these elements of sambandha jnana are going to come up. You're trying to figure out, who am I? What is this universe? What's our relationship? I think I'm the enjoyer, but at the same time, am I really? Right? So I'm enjoying all this thing, but at the same time, I have no satisfaction. Right? I have to die. That means the senses and the sense objects that I identify with stay. I go. So who am I? Right? Does that make sense? So then what is this universe? How is it actually functioning? And what is actually my relationship with it? Does that make sense? So that someone who's intelligent, then he will ask like this. These questions of the disattached person are answered by the ancient Atman, or the spirit. These spiritual explanations are made, collected together, and known as the philosophy or the science of religion. In our country, the self-evident revealed scriptures, like Vedas, are the original source of spiritual science. Even after accepting the supremacy of the Vedanta and the Vedic scriptures, many contradictory doctrines like Nyaya, Shankhya, Patanjali, Vaisheshika, and Karma Mimamsa, which apparently follow the Vedas, and the anti-Vedic doctrines like Buddhism, Charvakyavism, etc., have come into existence in India. Various doctrines of materialism, positivism, secularism, pessimism, skepticism, pantheism, atheism, etc., have been preached in the countries like China, Greece, Persia, France, England, Germany, Italy, etc. Certain doctrines have come into existence which establish the presence of God by means of empiric logic. Another doctrine has been preached in the various parts of the world which says that one should worship God out of faith. This religion based upon faith is of two types. Okay, so now we're starting actually into the technicalities of the Tattva Vivek. Now he's breaking it down. In other words, basically you're starting at the top, then when you're dealing with the science of religion, right here, what do I call it? Philosophy or science of religion. So when you take these spiritual explanations, all of that put together, that's the science or philosophy of religion. Right? So now you start off. One is that through empiricism, through logic, you're going to understand God. The other is through faith. Okay, so that's right there is your big two. Right? And the one stops there. Everything else goes on the other side, basically. So now, then, of those two with faith, then that becomes split. And then all these will keep getting split. So after some time, we have a chart of this. So when we get further into studying this, then we'll give out this chart so you can see it all. Okay. This religion based upon faith is of two types. Either preached as merely based upon human faith, or preached in various countries as God-given religion. Right? So in other words, you feel like it, or it came from God. Does that make sense? So then you're going to have the element of, there may be some kind of revelation, but still, it's not coming from the scriptures. Does that make sense? It's not coming from the revealed scriptures. So, yeah, that makes sense? Like that. So it's connected to God, but it's still human faith. It's not perfect. When the religion is purely based upon faith, it is known as theism. Where the religion is told to be God-given, it is known by the names like Christianity, Mohammedism, etc., following the respective scriptures. Right? Because then you're starting off, someone has that faith, but then God gives the scripture, God gives the instruction. Does that make sense? Right? Moses is there, they have that faith, that something is there. Then God gives them something. Or Abraham is there, and then something's given. Does that make sense? The answer is given by the Spirit for the previously mentioned three types of questions are essentially of two types, namely, characteristic answer and multifarious answer. Right? So if it's simply you have faith, that's theism. You believe in God, but it doesn't have any specific direction. When it's God-given, then it has a specific name. Right? It'll be of a specific faith and all that. Then these answers that are given, you'll have generic answers, just characteristic of them, or there'll be something, so many varieties of answers. A doubt may arise in this regard that when the individual spirits are universally homogeneous principle, why they will provide various diverse answers to the same question. Right? It means all the souls are the same. You're dealing with the jiva tattva, so why should there be different kinds of answers to these questions? Right? Why it should be varied? The cause of this controversy is explained as follows. The unalloyed spirit is a pure transcendental principle. When they remain in their characteristic nature, all of them will provide the same answer to the same given question, to a given question. But this world, which has been inhabited by the bonded souls, is not the normal abode of theirs. This mundane world is the abode of Maya, or the condemned, limited potency of the Supreme Lord. This has been manifested by that Maya, who is the shadow of the internal potency of the Supreme Lord. Since the bonded souls inhabited in this mundane world of Maya have accepted the phenomenal qualities of Maya as their own, their real character has been eclipsed and covered by the Mayic qualities, which has created a conditioned state, conditioned nature of the jiva souls. Because of the conditioned nature obtained from Maya, the transcendental jiva soul acquires a mixed character, and all its sentient facilities are conducted here under external conditionings. Right. Does that make sense? So the soul's in the natural position. Then if you ask them the question about Godhead and about themselves, you get the same answer. Right? But as soon as then they come within conditioning, then this world, because it has variety, then their conditioning also is going to have variety, so their answers are going to be various. Does that make sense? Right? That's why it says in the Gita that someone who doesn't see the soul thinks the body's the soul. That's the mode of ignorance. Someone who thinks that there are different kinds of souls, that's the mode of passion. Someone who understands the souls are all the same, that's the mode of goodness. Right? The quality of every soul, no matter what living entity, is the same. But some will say, oh, a Christian soul is good, you know, and non-Christian soul is not good. Or a Muslim soul is good, non-Muslim soul is not good. Like that. But no, the souls are the same. Does that make sense? But here you're getting multivarious answers for the same question. Ask who is God, they'll say is this, is that, and so many different things. So they're not talking about the same thing. Right? They are, but they don't know it. Yes?
What is the principle that is behind that?
What is the principle?
Yeah.
Because see, it means the living entity is going to, in their attachment, you know, in their dealing with the sense objects, that's why we opened with it, then they're going to get attracted to a particular kind of sense object. So that's going to require them to live in a certain place at a certain time under certain conditions and interact with certain people. Right? So that's all those people in that area are going to have a similar mentality. So their inspiration, their understanding of the absolute truth, their value system is going to be similar. So they'll naturally have one way of understanding things and discussing things. But you go just on the other side of the mountain and the situation is different. They think different, they eat different, they dress different, their values are different. So they'll have a different way to explain religion, the science of religion. You understand? Everybody's explaining the same science. There's only one science. But because of their conditioning, they're looking at it different. Like there's only one light, but then you, depending upon the color of glass, it looks like it's red or green or yellow or, you know, like blue. Like, does that make sense? But otherwise, it's the same light. So what's happening is, one, you're seeing it in its natural form, and the other is you're seeing it through the modes of nature. So depending upon the mix of modes, then you're going to get all these different kinds of understandings of the one absolute truth. Does that make sense? Right? Okay. So now, up to now, we've gotten... In this formula, we've gotten those who are going to try to understand God without faith, just through logic, and then those who are willing to use logic, I mean faith. Those who are dealing with faith, you're going to have those who have faith in God but don't have any specific direction for that. So that person then is theistic. They believe in God, but they don't really have any specific direction, so they don't have a system, actually. The other is going to then be following some system, some God-given system. Right? But the difficulty is that in the material platform, then they're going to end up with a variety of different ideas of what they think is the reality of the science of religion. Right? Does it make sense up to now? How it's going? Because what will be discussed here is whatever kind of, it means in this generic category of philosophy or religion there is in the world that human beings can deal with, it's going to be explained here. But I remember you have about 26 different varieties. Like that, so everything can fit into these. Right? The faculty of transcendental knowledge of the jiva souls gets degraded into a mixture of sentient and non-sentient principles due to the association of inanimate world, and gets converted and presented as the mind of the jiva souls. Right? Gets converted and presented. Remember we were saying it's when the mind enters it. Then it gets converted, so you think that this is what it is. So by those modes, then they'll be conscious of some things or not conscious of some things. But it's based on their observation of the material world. It'll be adjusted by that. Does that make sense? The mixed principle of mind, then influenced by the variegatedness of Maya, provides the answers of the different questions, assuming the ego of the soul. Right? So here we're seeing is that the living entity identifies as the mind, not the soul. So they actually think the mind is the soul. Right? Some take it to think the body is the soul. Right? That's why if it's not an all-in-one piece, you know, then after you die, when you bury it, if all the pieces aren't there, then you're not going to get to wherever you're supposed to get, because they think the body is the soul, like that. Or if they're a little more subtle, then the mind is the soul. But he's saying it's because the living entity identifies with the sense objects, that's how they observe. Those objects having entered the mind, that becomes their perspective. And so they think, this is me. Right? Does that make sense? The answers given by the different jiva souls are invariably influenced by their associations of different behaviors, culture, clothing, food habits, language, line of thought, etc., in accordance with the location of this world wherein they live. In this way, natural variegatedness is always visualized according to the variation of time, space, and person. The basic variation is due to the alloyed nature of the fallen jiva souls, and then due to the various places, languages, and origins, the variations become multifarious. Right? So the basic variation is coming in because the soul is alloyed. You understand? Alloyed? Mixed. Right? Unalloyed means unmixed. It means alloyed means that it's mixed. So this jiva is already mixed with the attitude, I'm the controller and enjoyer. So that already is going to be different than dealing with the eternal religion. So you're already getting a mixed answer now. So more conscious, they may be more conscious of the eternal religion, less conscious of it. Then you bring it into the sphere of each individual, how they are conditioned in the world. So what situation they end up in. Right, so then that covers it further. Does that make sense? That's why you can always deal with generic and then specific. You understand the principle of something, so then you have an entrance into the specifics of the individual. Does that make sense? You understand horses, you can deal with any horse in general, but each horse is specific, so there'll be some uniqueness to it, but it's still based on the principle of how a horse behaves. Does that make sense? So you know the nature of the jiva, you know the nature of human being, right? So there you already have something. Then you also know the principles of all these different kinds of mentalities that people can have. Knowing that, then you're able to understand how you're going to discuss with that person, how you're going to understand, right? Or in one's own conditioning, how you've gotten to that point, so therefore how to reverse it, right? We always start from, you start from one place and come down. Then you understand how you got there. Then you reverse it, go back, right? The soul comes into the world, then starts with the senses, observing the sense objects. And so in the beginning, it's just some fun, right? Then after some time, then one actually gets attached to that and identifies with it, because those objects enter the mind. Right. then in that position, then you think this is me, and so then you have a whole perspective. Now, if you want to reverse that, what do you have to do? You have to understand you aren't those things and get those things to not be entering the mind. Right? It doesn't mean you take it and stop observing. No, you observe, but you understand I'm not this body, I'm not this mind, I'm not the senses. I'm separate. So whatever observation in that is there, you have. But that will be now properly engaged in the source. Yes? So there's always this principle of reversing. All these multifarious doctrines of varied nature can be properly analyzed and understood by that person alone who has traveled all the places of the world, by learning all those respective languages, and who has studied the various traditions of those places. Here we are compelled to point out only at the general hints. Right? So if you really want to know about all this multifarious, then you have to travel everywhere, study them all, then you understand what they're talking about. So he's saying, therefore, we're just going to deal with the general hints, right? So in other words, what he's doing here is bringing it that we'll accept the principle as being practical. Otherwise, the tendency, because principle is so simple, we'll write it off. Okay, you said it in one sentence and I understood it, so it can't be, you know, there must be more sophisticated and developed. No, that's just detail, right? So otherwise, we'll say, well, you don't know unless you... No, we're talking about the generic principles. So now he's got it so that it'll be like... So he's made a thing. So if you want to know that, you want to understand all that, you'd have to go everywhere, see every culture, get into everything, study everything, then you would know all the things. Then you could understand this. Right? But that's not practical. Right? People go around, do it, they'll get to a few places, they can't get to every place. Right? Here we are compelled to point out only at the general hints. Among the two types of answers given by the Spirit, the second one, or the characteristic answer, is truly reasonable. Even though the conditioned answers are multifarious, they can be scientifically divided into two categories. Right? So in other words, now we're getting down to the next split. We have the empiricists, we have those with faith. Of faith, we have those that are going to go by the characteristic, you know, which will be basically, I think that will be pointed out as to be, that is devotional service. Then the other, what's multifarious, is now is going to be divided, right? So now the division again, here we're going to get, the first category is the jnana, or the knowledge, and the second is karma, or activity. A question may arise here that if the correct answer is reasonable, then the reasoning or rationalization is prominently adhered to. Does the rationalization not agree with the natural variations? In reply to this, we say that the worldly language itself is influenced by the variation or relativity of the nature, and therefore these languages are not capable of independently entering the field of transcendence. Right? So, you're going to look at, so if the general answer is going to work so nicely, does it agree with all these regional variations? Right? Because we're dealing with faith. Remember, that's the topic, is then the faith. So within that is, within faith, that's been divided into just having faith, being theistic, or being of a specific doctrine. So will the characteristic answer of the soul match with these multifarious answers given by the conditioned soul? Does that make sense? Like that. So that's the question that's coming up now. Because if it's going to be practical, we're just hinting at something, be practical, it should work in all time, places, and circumstances. Right? Because if it doesn't, then you'd have to go to the certain time, place, and circumstance, and then look at it and try to understand the situation. Does that make sense? So then that question comes up. So the difficulty is that those, all these different worldly languages, and they're influenced by the relativity of the nature, right? The language is there to express what the person is experiencing. So naturally, his language is influenced by his conditioning. Right? So therefore, there's going to be a difference in it. It doesn't have the capacity to describe transcendence. Right? So we run into a difficulty here. Therefore, the words yukti, reason, and yukta, reasonable, which have been used here, should be understood as only for the explanation of the purely transcendental faculties. Right? So the yukti and yukta, what's yukti is the reason, and that reason is reasonable. Right? It works, it's practical, it's logical. So that then we can only leave for the transcendental reality. In other words, the Sanatana Dharma. That will explain that. Everything else won't be able to explain it because the language is not actually, doesn't have that ability to do it because it's been influenced by the external. Right? And we're trying to explain the soul. Does that make sense? This faculty of spiritual reasoning then gets associated with the material phenomena. When gets associated with the material phenomena, becomes conditioned rationalization and produces the multifarious doctrines. Right? It means, okay, the spiritual reasoning connected with material energy, then you rationalize things. And by that rationalization, you're going to get different, right? You have five guys, and they're rationalizing why they do what they do, right? So that will be according to their mundane vision. So you're going to get actually five different answers. Does that make sense? So this is the difficulty. When this faculty is stationed in its own characteristic nature, it provides the truly reasonable answer. Among the two scientific categories of the multifarious answers, the first one, known as jnana, is the visual faculty of the conditioned spirit to discriminate between the eternal and the transient objects. Synthetically, this jnana upholds a material character by revealing the beginningless and the universal aboriginality of the matter. On the other hand, this jnana analytically denies the existence of the matter and establishes a featureless doctrine of Brahman without any qualities. Okay. So now you're going to have a difficulty is that of these two scientific means, the karma and jnana. The jnana is going to establish that they're the material objects and all that. There's the eternal and then there's the temporary. But because of this conditioning and all that is there, they'll have the beginningless of everything and the originalness, but then they'll end up, because they're looking at that aspect which dissolves the material, then they end up only having that dissolved aspect. Does that make sense? We were discussing this morning about the form and the formless. So if you use the formless understanding of something to break the attachment to the form, right, so therefore they establish the beginningless, the eternality of it, the transcendence, as opposed to the gross manifestation. But then the problem is because it's only knowledge, that's where it remains. Does that make sense? So the faith is in knowledge. So we can see it's a religion of knowledge. Right? It's not of this other where it's actually in some, you know, basically dealing with the person. So then they'll say matter doesn't exist because it's actually the form is real. Because if the matter exists and there's a transcendence, that's contradictory. So how do you solve that? So you'd have to have something. If I have two things that are contradictory, there has to be something above them that's common. Does that make sense? I have two things that are opposite. It doesn't make any sense until I go above that. to where they come from. Then I can see, oh, here's where it's... So that would mean now I'm just taking it, material existence is here, then it, that is illusory. But what is inside that is the formless aspect, that's what then makes it work. So actually it's the formless that's eternal. All this is illusion, so this doesn't exist, so all we have is the form. So then they move forward in the formless and remain there. Does that make sense? So if they accept that the form, the formless, the form is there and the formless is there simultaneously, right? And they're both working with each other, then that means there must be an origin of both. So the formless can't be the origin, right? Because formless is generic. Formless is formless. So whether it's here or, you know, everywhere, the cause of create is still the formless. So that means there's the formless, and then there's the material energy. So then what's above those two? Right? So then we're talking about that formless has to come. Because if it's going to come from somewhere and actually be real, that means it has to come from a real person who has form. Does that make sense? Like that. If it's all formless and that's the origin, then this is just an illusion. Okay, how the concept of illusion came up, how you could go about having it, how everybody has it, you know, that they don't bother to question so much. Right? Oh, pastime, this, that. But pastime means there's a person, right? But whatever it is, that's why they're not considered. They're intelligent, but not that intelligent. Right? Mayaya Pratigyana. They kind of lose something in the translation. Okay. Is this clear up to now? Right? Going through step by step, because he's just going through one at a time. Gets here, and then he'll split it again and show that, go to the next, and split again like that. On the other hand, the second category called karma is the atheistic activity of the fallen souls in cultivating the material association by means of the gross body. The unalloyed jnana and karma of the transcendental soul in cultivating the spiritual sentiments and inclinations will be discussed in the subject of bhakti under the characteristic answer of the soul. Right. So, in other words, he's taking bhakti and putting it on the side for now, so we'll get back to that. So in the characteristic answer, right, that is bhakti, right? But these multifarious answers, right? You know, this Vedavada Rata, just the many kinds of directions the mind can go, those ones then create all these different things. So you get karma, you get jnana. Does that make sense? Because of the natural inertia of the sentences, it is quite difficult to express the unalloyed spiritual principles by means of worldly languages. Natural inertia of the sentences. All right, so in other words, the language isn't, how you say? It's difficult to express the unalloyed principles, especially when you're using other languages. If you're using Sanskrit, then its design, Prabhupada mentions that Sanskrit, what it says is what it means. The syllable is referring to the thing that it actually deals with. Well, in English, maybe it was originally, but it's, you know, it somehow or another got diverted. And then people just, you know, use whatever they use. Like that. Does that make sense? You know, it just goes down. And what is it? How you say? It's, you start off with, I was just reading today, you have Aryan, you know, I mean someone who follows the Vedic culture. Aryan. And then from that, it, you know, it went out, and then in Iran, Iran is actually their pronunciation of Aryan. Right? And then that has come into a language, and then that broke down into many languages and cultures, and one of the languages that's still present today is called Iran. You spell it I-R-O-N, like iron, Iron. But it's actually meaning that. From that, then you get, there was a group of persons that were practicing that they were called the Alans. Right? And then from that, then they're also, they went out to different places. And then I think now it's called something Ossian. And it's somewhere up in, you know, how you say, Georgia and that area of, like, Russia and that area. The Ossians and stuff like that. And so this Ossian is actually meaning Aryan. But no one would ever know that that's where it's from. Does that make sense? So the language doesn't necessarily, because of this effect that Bhaktivinoda Thakur is talking about, it doesn't represent actually what it is. Sanskrit does. Each syllable actually means and represents what it says. So it's scientific, it doesn't change. It doesn't change by popular usage. Right? Popular usage may prefer a particular word over another word because of the poetics of it or that. That may be the thing, but it's still dealing with the real explanation. So he's pointing out here is that, you know, basically we're doing the best we can using this, you know, strange language called English. Like that. No? Okay. Okay. Conditioned doctrines are of innumerable types, whereas the characteristic doctrine is homogeneous. Let us first of all briefly delineate the conditioned doctrines, and thereafter the discussion about the characteristic doctrine will follow. So now he'll go into, he's giving many verses here, because he's going through his sutras, but unfortunately these original translations, they expect that the reader reads Sanskrit and appreciates it. So though they write it in English, the verses are still in Devanagari, so you don't get the full benefit of what's here. So now he's going to go through all these conditioned natures, and then from that, once that's clear, then he's going to go and actually discuss bhakti as the conclusion. Okay? Does this make sense, how this is working? Is everybody comfortable with this? We're understanding how this is unfolding? So that's it. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi. Someone cut off the corners, you know, so the book doesn't get ruined. No book. Somebody else's book. Oh! Okay. It's translated by the Sringa Brahmachari, so maybe that's why. It's done like that, huh? I always thought that was a sticker put on the front, but it's not. It's the way they published the book.
Can you make a copy of it?
I'm going to try to find a